Julia nervously emerges from her shabby tent in the suburban wastelands on the outskirts of Madrid to face another day of survival in one of Europe's most problematic ghettos. She is homeless, wanted by the police, and addicted to both heroin and cocaine. She's also 5 months pregnant and rarely makes contact with the support services. Welcome to the city shadows in Valdemingomez, a lawless landscape of drugs and violence where the third world meets the Wild West. Daniel Briggs and his co-author entered this area with only their patients, some cigarettes and a mobile phone, and collected video testimonies and images of Julia and others like her who lived there. He's published in a book called Dead End Lives, Drugs and Violence in the City Shadows. Delighted to be welcoming on the line Daniel Briggs. Daniel, good morning to you.
Good morning. Hello there.
We seem to think of Spain as a modern, progressive country. The cities are gleaming. We have AVE links going to every major city on the mainland. We have great telecommunications, but we also have huge social problems. Scratch away the surface and you'll find places like Valdemingomez.
Yeah, totally. I mean, the study that I've just completed, which was done over 2 years of this Spain's largest drug market just on the outskirts of Madrid, was really looking at why precisely the 5,000 people ended up going to this specific place per day. Why is it that the drug market was concentrated on the outskirts of the city? Why was it not infecting the city centre? So during the course of the research, you know, I was studying or the closure of other smaller poblados where lots of gypsies were having their camps, sites for private investment, sites for gentrification. And what happened is a lot of those poblados were closed and they concentrated in the outskirts of Madrid in Valdemingomez. And that basically coupled with various other processes related to increased social control of gypsies, of drug users, and increasingly aggressive social policies on homeless people in general. So what city public policy has done over the last 15, 20 years in Madrid, and likely most other Western cities, is basically get rid of the blemishes of the city, which are a barrier to capital investment.
You bring into consideration one of the things that I've noticed as well is the fact that the gentrification of Spanish cities and in many Western cities as well. I mean, I used to live in South London, in Battersea, in Clapham, Streatham, and those were areas that were, you know, in the 80s were overlooked, and now they become gentrified and the population moves on. I've seen this happen massively in places like Valencia, for example, when the America's Cup came to Valencia 10 years ago, and they basically obliterated these barrios to put up gleaming new apartments and hotels, and the population, the native population, the gitanos as well, were moved out and set up where they could do. And the same is happening in Madrid, and the same is happening in Malaga and in Sevilla as well.
Yeah, and there was another piece of research which documented a similar trend I did in La Coruña. So it's fairly commonplace. It's basically what, and also that lives in people's minds. Of course, if people, the everyday citizen, doesn't see things like drug dealing or drug users or gypsies going about their business selling chatarra or something like that, then of course they don't see problems with the city. The city seems to be perceived like, as you say, like a safe place or whatever. But really what's happened is the social problems are congregated and pushed out to these sort of liminal spaces on the outskirts where they just fester, and there's very limited intervention which can take place because every day, for example, police close down the kiosks and the fumaderos where people take the drugs, but more and more open up in the same area. And at the same time, you get the harm reduction team turn up and try and give people safe injecting equipment so they take the drugs safely, but they're in such a disheveled condition that really a way out for them is basically impossible. Now, these people have used drugs for years, in some case decades. They've got physical problems, mental health problems. Most of them have got AIDS, hepatitis C, gangrene in some cases. So, you know, to expect them to somehow summon a personal will to get themselves recovered is almost impossible, which is why a lot of them just die there.
I mean, would you say, I mean, not trying to be too controversial, but would you say that the attitude, I mean, we have huge education problems and youth unemployment problems in Spain throughout. I mean, we're based in, this station is based in Andalusia, but goes through the whole of Spain, broadcast the whole of Spain. In Andalusia, as in the whole of Spain, it's particularly a problem of youth unemployment. The social services network perhaps isn't as it should be, and And a lot of the, shall we say, the politicians or the institutions may just look at these people and say, well, they're drug addicts, they deserve what they get, they're not just regular people. And the Gitano issue is one that can run and run, and we could do an entire show for the rest of the week on that particular program. But do you think that perhaps it's they tend to turn a blind eye and say, right, get these people out, they're not tourist friendly, they're the people that they're dispossessed, the people we don't want when we're trying to put a face on as a European nation?
Well, I mean, you touched on lots of issues there, but I think one way of joining all that together is basically the fact that, you know, in relation to the high employment level in Andalusia, which I think is the highest in the country, but basically a lot of these people are victims of the kind of drying up of the domestic economy, coupled with the exportation of the labour market outside of Spain. So deindustrialization has created swathes of basically surplus people, young people included, who don't really have a stake in society. And you have to kind of get by on temporal jobs, which are meaningless, or in some cases just might get a contract for a week or so, whatever. So these people are very much swept up in these kind of wider prices related to how the economy is diminished, and basically shut them out of various opportunities. And at the same time, how in the being shut out of those opportunities, that has coincided with the increasing prevalence of the drug market since the 1980s and 1990s. So, and again, you know, you mentioned the Gitanos in the in what you say as well. You look at how look at the policy procedures that have been taking place against them. A lot of them 30 years ago were harmlessly selling chatarra, doing these kind of market businesses in city centres. And now once council started to increase the need for licensing and come down hard on them with other kind of aggressive policies, basically you force them also to rethink how they have to survive. So, of course, the drug market is an opportunity. It's lucrative. And basically all these things have married into one giant process. And this is what the consequence of Alden and Gomez is, was this sort of dead-end place where people just end up living in rubbish and sleeping in rats.
So, I mean, so tell me a little bit about the place itself, Valdomín Gómez. It's just outside Madrid. Is it North Madrid, South Madrid, East Madrid? I mean, where would we find it?
It's the southeast corner of Madrid, going out towards the A3 towards Valencia. So it's about 12 kilometres from the capital, not even that far, actually. So it's about 15 minutes, 20 minutes in the car from the centre. Conveniently next to Madrid's rubbish dump as well. I think that speaks volumes, doesn't it? Valdomín Gómez is one of six sectors of the Cañada Real Galeana. And the Cañadas, many years ago, were used to transport cattle up and down across the country. And of course, up until the industrial period, I think really just post-war, they were pretty well used. But then, of course, when infrastructure started to develop in Spain, and roads and rail became more common, then those cañadas kind of became defunct and obsolete. So, and then when people started to move from the rural areas, such as Andalusia as well, some people I interviewed came from the south to look for work in the construction industries, which was booming. They congregated in, well, the only places they could afford, really. And if it wasn't in these kind of ghettos on the south outskirts of the city of Madrid, then it was in places like these sort of no-man lands, where they would just have these kind of improvised constructions and try and get by. And of course, with the crash we had in 2008, that's basically frozen a lot more people out of the economy, out of the construction industry. I know Mr. Rajoy tells us that things are improving. I'm very dubious about the statistics, but a lot of those people end up unemployed, having family problems as a consequence, losing their networks, and basically investing their time and energy in taking drugs, and thereafter it's a very sad spiral.
I mean, you look at the pictures in the book, and yeah, to describe it as a shanty town would put, you know, it looks like something that we would lose to seeing in Soweto or the favelas of Brazil, or even before it was bulldozed, the refugee camps in Calais. I mean, it is quite a sight, and to think of human beings actually living in these conditions next to what's supposed to be, you know, a city that not so long ago was bidding for an Olympics, really does make you wonder how people end up there and how they can get out of the situation. And why did you decide to go in there, Daniel?
Well, again, I said, you know, you mentioned the Calais jungle. I was there just last year, and even the camp next door in Dunkirk as well, where the conditions are even worse. People literally living in just mud, you know, rubbish piled everywhere. So, you know, it really is like another world, and it's very difficult to conceive that in the 21st century, in a city as rich and as wealthy as Madrid, that these things can happen. And you know, you talk about the Olympic bids. I think Madrid failed three times to get the Olympic bid, but it made a massive investment in trying to get it, and in doing so, tried to. This was another part of the process, which about moving the drug markets, moving the gitanos out of the city. It was another kind of double, a dual process there. But I don't know. It's the image is really a testimony to, I don't know, the very sad survival protocols that people have to get by. You know, a lot of these people can't really commit crime anymore, so they end up doing favours and robbing each other and being violent against each other in this very same space. And some of the women that I got to know over the 2 years there were giving sexual services for literally a couple of euros. Mm-hmm. And as you see, there's one image in the book where of a young woman we came to know who actually disappeared, and she lost a baby during the course of the research. And in the picture, she had gone off to look for like a baby from the rubbish. She pulled up this sort of toy, this like plastic toy of a baby, and basically fell asleep with it in her arms. And it's tragic. You start listening to these people's lives, and you know, you can very much see that this wasn't necessarily a conscious decision to start taking drugs or start ending up, you know, living with rubbish and things like that. No one wants to do that with their life. But you know, when you start to unpack what's going on, you can see that these people are very much victims of how the capitalist economy has treated them.
You focus in part on Julia. Yeah. In the beginning. I mean, how did you come across Julia, and you know, how difficult was it to write about somebody, to interview somebody like that, who is in that spiral of what looks like, you know, a hopeless situation, addicted to heroin, cocaine, wanted by the police, homeless, yeah, 5 months pregnant.
This relates, I think, to your initial question where you said, why did I go in there? Because it bothers me a lot that these kind of projects don't get done. And I remember, I've been here 4 years now in Madrid, and I submitted three research proposals, because these days, if you work at a university, you have to get money to do research. I submitted three proposals to the government to try and get funding to do it, and none of them were accepted. So in the end, my colleague and I, a former student of mine who was literally 22 at the time with no experience, we just thought, well, let's do it ourselves. Let's go there. And we did it for under €1,000 between us over 2 years, which was money paid for petrol and the cigarettes that we offered people to talk to us. And, you know, over that period, I got to know Julia, and I found out she was pregnant. Well, it was fairly obvious she was pregnant. She was carrying a baby. It's fairly obvious. But she kept denying it to herself. And I think for me personally as a researcher, just seeing the impossibility of how things are around me, and just, my role shifted, and we made it a priority to every time we saw her try and persuade her to present to the service and things like that. And I'm not saying that we had any ounce of success, but certainly when I saw her earlier this year, having had her baby, it seems like that we may have played some role in her decision to come out of there, because she's now safe and well with a young daughter.
How difficult is it for people to break out of this cycle, though? Because if the social services aren't able to help, haven't got the ability to help, and policy of either government or town halls or whatever is to move all the, you know, put all the junkies, put all the gitanos in one space, and then now and again we can go and knock it all down and have a big show of force. How difficult is it for people to not feel alienated, to break that killing cycle of drug dependence and despondency?
Very, because a lot of these people, at the point of arriving in somewhere like Valdemingolmez, are very mentally battered. So there are various complex physical and mental issues that don't really go in sync with the way drug treatment or drug rehabilitation is designed. In Spain, the state recognizes drugs as like some sort of illness. And if it's an illness, then it needs a cure. So a lot of this philosophy means that the way it's treated is simply by, you know, giving people methadone or giving them some sort of tokenistic therapy. And, you know, it's very difficult. for that to be enough, especially because it doesn't really take into account the social or the psychological side of it. Also, I say that the kind of barriers, the personal barriers are not only immense, but the fact that these people have to wait around on waiting lists for months to get a place in a rehab, and then wait around again for some some social housing is almost impossible as well. I think over the last 10 years, Madrid has sold something like 91% of its social housing to private investors. So there's just a backlog of people who really can't get anywhere, not only out of the cycle of drug addiction, but even beyond that, it looks very difficult. And then even then, if they get some social housing, what is it waiting for them in the economy? A job that they might get in a store or packing boxes or something like that, which they may have for a week or whatever. And this is why a lot of them, if they get that far, they relapse quite quickly. But if they get bored, what is on offer is not enough to fill that kind of psychological gap. So a lot of them return to this kind of default setting of taking drugs.
And how willing were people to talk to you about this, you know, in the situation? Because obviously there is some pride involved with this. The Gitanos are a very proud bunch of people. They're very proud of what they got. How willing were they to take, you know, a giddy like yourself into their communities, and also, you know, people who are suffering from drug problems, from health problems, from mental problems as well? I mean, you must have been watching your back at certain points during this research and going into the area.
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably not the best advertisement for this kind of research, but because it is quite risky. You know, as you say, you know, the Gitanos are quite violent. They keep guns on. There's a lot of fights between them, and they're very hostile to people coming into the area, anyone they don't know or anything, which is why, for example, in the first 9 months of the study, we didn't make any interviews whatsoever. We simply turned up to the place, walked around, started informal conversations with people. We had clothes which might insinuate that we were also drug users, so we kind of blended in a little bit. And it's just a case of getting your face known, and then we started getting some of the trust from some of the drug users, some of the harm reduction team, and that's when we started to really progress forward with our interviews. Hairy moments, yeah. I mean, you've seen in the book, we were going into some of these gypsy-run kiosks and fumaderos where, you know, guns were readily available. There were arguments and disputes when people are high on cocaine and heroin. So, and that's not to mention the very physical risks of the actual environment. I mean, it's a rubbish dump, basically, and literally within a square meter, there are at least several used syringes and needles everywhere. So, you know, you fall over and you may risk catching some sort of virus or disease or something. So, yeah, it's not easy research, but do you know what? If we didn't do it, who would know about it? Because no one really wants to know about it.
Yeah, nobody wants to know about it. What do you think? You know, you've published the book now. It's out on Policy Press. What are your hopes for the book itself? And also, you know, what can we do? What can charities do about situations like Valdomín Gómez?
I don't know. With the key is charities. I mean, at least what the book tries to do is present in very honest terms the complete moot point of the situation. And I think in doing that, then that should act as the way forward, not to try and pretend that by making some small social policy adjustments or tweaking some police tactics is going to improve things. You know, the drug market clearly is here to stay. There is a demand. There are people queuing up to work in the drug market. So, you know, I think that at a broader level, the changes need to come from the higher up social structure. It's to do with the economy, culture, and things like that. And my hope for the book is that people read it. I'm very grateful the Policy have got it in a priced at $13.89, I think, through their website. I'm not advertising anything whatsoever. But I'm grateful that it could have a good readership for that reason. I've tried to write it in a way that anyone can pick it up. I'm not an academic that likes to use big words, or you know, just so that I look important or clever. I think people need to read and learn how society works. They need to feel upset about it, so that they can think about how they vote, what they want to do about society. Well, that's my hope anyway.
The book is called Dead and Dead End Lives, Drugs and Violence in City Shadows. It's out now on the Policy Press. Daniel, if people want to find out more about that, they go to policypress.co.uk.
Yep. Can I also add that I'm very grateful for you to give me this time. And, you know, you asked me about my hope for the book. Well, is to talk through mediums like this and have people ask me pressing questions about the book and about the people that live there. That's what's most important to me. So I'm really grateful. Thank you.
No problem. If people want to open a dialogue with yourself, though, and find out more about the area and perhaps, you know, what they can do or be made more aware of the situation, because I do think people, you know, we drive by these people, you know, in our flash cars or our cars, and you see them on the sides of the roads driving into Sevilla, for example. I see that as well. There's some well-known places, the towers in Sevilla and in Valencia, as I said before. I mean, I think it's important that we don't disregard these people. If people want to open up a dialogue with yourself, how can they get in touch with you, Daniel?
I'm very happy to receive any emails from any of your listeners, answer any of their questions. My email address is daniel.briggs@universidadeuropea.es. I don't know whether I should have said that in Spanish or not.
Well,
it's the same, isn't it?
Indeed. So it's daniel.briggs at
Universidad Europea.com.
.es, sorry, excuse me.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, do you do the social media thing? Do you do the Twitter or the Facebook?
Yeah,
or...
I'm on Twitter, unfortunately. not for my own ego or anything at all, but literally to try and recruit people to at least take note of the things I see and hopefully read about them. Yes, I'm on Twitter, Dr. Dan Briggs.
Right, well, Dr. Dan Briggs, it's been a pleasure to speak to you this morning, author of Dead End Lies, fascinating subject, and other things, a dialogue we need to have open. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you.